good to listen to me again. I know I started off the summer. I'm speaking again. I want to start off class tonight, or well, not tonight. For me, it's night since I work nights. But I want to start off class by talking about Velton. When we got here earlier, I think Teddy had been standing outside, and then Velton either came out and then went back in, and he came out with a leaf blower, and he came out with an extension cord. And you could tell he was about to use the leaf blower and clean up the parking lot a bit. And I admired it. I mean, I don't see Velton do all that much outside. I mean, you know, he gets up here earlier than most. He unlocks the doors, gets everything set, gets the thermostat set, has people complain about it being too cold, has others complain about it being too hot. And then he just sets it how he wants it because he's the only one that matters. Of course, that's not Velton. But he turned on the leaf blower and he started cleaning up. And I came in and I got redressed from work, got a bit more dressed up since I was teaching. And I went out and he was still using the leaf blower. And like I said, I admired it because he was taking care of the building. Now, this is leading into our discussion, but what about if it came to be 9:30 and instead of Velton sitting right next to his wife in the back like he normally is, he was outside and he was putting on a fresh coat of paint? Or what if there was a window busted somewhere so he was taking care of the window that was busted in the church? What if there was something else that needed to be taken care of and instead of being with us here in Bible class, he was taking care of that? Is he putting importance where it should be? No, he is putting importance on something else. He's putting importance on a building. How many noticed earlier that instead of using the word building, I use the word church when talking about the building? I don't know how many did, but it's something that I think at times we'll do without even thinking of it. We'll be talking to someone and we'll say, well, you know what, I'm about to go to the church. I'm about to go take care of some business at the church. And they mean they're going to go up to the building, they're going to do something. Is the building really the church? The soup kitchen in town over on 14th Street, they have a sign up in their, what, I guess it's their fellowship hall or their place where they do their soup kitchen. And it says on it, this is the Lord's house. And every time, normally Rachel and I would go there during Christmas and we would help in the soup kitchen. And every time I go there, I look at that and it hurts because I'm like, this isn't the Lord's house. This is a church building. Now, people might put more importance on it than they should because of certain civil figures, as in, if I was to come here and I was to set this building on fire, instead of it just being arson, it's aggravated arson because it's a church building. It's the same with, I believe, cemeteries and with schools. If you do something on church property, it automatically makes it an aggravated. If you do something to an employee of the church, it makes it an aggravated crime just because he is a part of a religious organization. But just because of that doesn't mean that this building is the church. So just to point us in the right direction, go ahead and open to 1 Timothy 3:15. 1 Timothy 3:15. And then if someone wouldn't mind also opening to Psalm 122, 1. So 1 Timothy 3:15 and Psalm 122, 1. And while we're looking at these, think of these questions. What is the house of the Lord? I've kind of already given you part of the answer. It's not the building. The church building is just a building. You could think of it as an expedient. It gives us a unified place where we can come together to worship instead of 100 and something people packing ourselves into Rick's house or into Dennis's house or into Chad's house or into insert a member's name's house. After that, what is worship? And then underneath, what is worship? How are we to worship? And what must we worship? And you might be sitting here, oh, really, James, come on. I mean, these are simple questions. For us, they might be simple questions, but there are some people outside that they would sit here and they would have to think about these questions because of religious confusion that has led to certain things not being taught properly. So look it with me at Psalm 122:1. Right at the top, it says it's the Psalm of David, and he starts off with, I was glad when they said unto me, let us go into the house of the Lord. David, instead of like some today being bashful or not really wanting to say that he's worshiped God, he says, I was glad, I was happy, I was exuberant when they said, let us go to the house of the Lord. He wanted to worship God. He was proud to worship God. You could say he was like Velton. Velton was taking care of the building, but Velton's in here to worship God. Now, if someone wouldn't mind reading 1 Timothy 3:15. 1 Timothy 3:15. Thank you. Look at that with me once more. Here, Paul talking to his son in the faith, Timothy, he tells him, but if I tarry long, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself. How thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth. So, the house of the Lord is not the building, but still we have to act a certain way when we're with the house of the Lord. We can't just walk in here looking disheveled or acting like a bunch of maniacs and expect everything to be honky-dory. We can't come in here and start talking like a maniac and expect no one to give us weird looks. Timothy most likely knew this, but Paul still told him so that he could go and tell others. So the first question we need to answer this morning is, what is the house of the Lord? Well, I mean, we've already answered what it isn't, and it is not the building. Instead, it is members which worship in the building. If you wouldn't mind, go with me to Acts chapter 11. Acts chapter 11. Acts chapter 11, notice verse 22. Excuse me. Now, notice the particular wording that Luke uses in verse 22. Then tidings of these things came unto the ears of what? Came unto the ears of the church, which was in Jerusalem, and they sent forth Barnabas that he should go as far as Antioch. So, if the church were the building, if the house of the Lord was the building, would it have ears? If we were to walk outside and we were to sit here and just start talking to the walls of the building, is it going to be able to hear what we're saying? No, it's an inanimate object. Now, someone could have made it architecturally to where it has ears, but those ears aren't going to do anything. Much like the idols that were worshipped. They could put a face on it that had a mouth and had a nose and had eyes and had ears, but it couldn't talk, it couldn't smell, it couldn't see, and it couldn't hear. So, it's not the building, it's the members. And that makes sense. I mean, Rick has ears, Mona has ears, all of us have ears. We can hear what's going on. In Acts chapter 11, the church had heard of what Peter had done in the house of Cornelius, and they're asking him, well, why did you go to a Gentile? Why did you do this? And he was telling them, look, I didn't just do it because I wanted to. I had this vision. God did this. God told me to go to them. And God told me to tell him the gospel. And I did so, and these things happened, showing that that the Gentiles were part of the promise of Acts chapter 2. And the church heard it. The church, the members heard it. The building that they were at, if they had a building, they might not have The building didn't hear it because it wouldn't have meant anything to the building, but to the people, it meant something. So the house of the Lord is not the building. And as I said, this is a common mistake we'll make. We might not even think about it. We might be talking to someone and they might say, church, talking about the building that they go to. And, oh, well, yeah, the church I go to, talking about the building. When I was in school, Brother T.J. Clark told us of when, I don't remember the reason that they were going out, but they were going to some of the local congregations. And one that he went to, they had just built themselves a very lavish building. And she brought him in and she told him, look at this nice church that we have. And she was showing him all of the finer things in it. And she was asking, well, what do you think about it? And he simply told her, I think the money that had been put into these finer things could have been used for more suitable things. But the point is that she made that common mistake. And it's a common mistake just because we can do it without even thinking. And we can do that with talking about other things in English. I mean, we might be talking about a car, and instead of saying car, we say something else absentmindedly. It's not something that we do on purpose, and it's not something that is particularly wrong. It's just we don't think about it. But the point being, the church is the members. The church is the body of Christ. The members make up the body of Christ. So it's the members. And this agrees with what Paul wrote in Timothy 3:15. How we are to behave ourselves in the house of the Lord. I mean, do some people come in here and they don't particularly know what's right from wrong when it comes to worship? Yes. Can we come in and we might not be thinking in the right manner? Yes, so we need to learn how to behave ourselves when we are gathered. We need to be able to focus our thoughts and focus our attention on the proper things instead of coming in and while we're supposed to be thinking on giving, well, where do I want to go for lunch? Where do we want to go for lunch? Oh, hey, I have that thing I need to take care of tomorrow. We need to learn how to focus ourselves. I guess you could say we need to train our mind and teach it how to behave when we're supposed to be worshiping. And then again, we can think, we can hear, the building can't. We need to know how to behave, the building doesn't. Makes sense. So what is the house of the Lord? Again, we could interchange that with what is the church, what is the body of Christ? It's the members. After that, what is worship? And, I mean, you could ask, what's worship? And you're going to get a bunch of different definitions. Most likely, it'll hit along the same lines. The one that Brother Winkler gave was courtesy and reverence paid to worth. And I think he got that from Webster's. I don't remember. So, courtesy and reverence paid to worth. The original words translated as worship have the idea of doing homage, which homage is a way of saying respect. Doing homage, reverence, standing in awe. We can think of the song, I Stand in Awe of You. You can think of the word awesome. Oh, dude, that's so awesome. Oh, that movie was so awesome. We can use the word in that sense, but when we really think of what the word is supposed to be used for, we can think of God instead, because God is awesome. He's made all the things that he's made for us, and what was his purpose in doing it? He made it for us. He made it so that we could enjoy it. He didn't make it because he had nothing better to do. He had many better things to do, but he created an earth in the right place and the exact distance needed from the sun and not too close to the sun. And he created it with enough oxygen, created it with enough water, created it with enough living things and other things that it would be suitable for life. And he did it for us because he could. And because of that, he is worthy for us to respect him, to say the least. He is worthy of us revering him. Revering meaning to worship him, to treat him better than we treat others. to put him first in our lives. So the original words translated worship have the idea of doing homage, revering, standing in awe. So how many types of worship do you think are talked about in the Bible? Not how many acts of worship, but how many types? At least two. There's four. Turn to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17, and notice verse 23 with me. There, Paul is on the Areopagus, and he's talking to those that are up there after he sees to the unknown God, the altar to the unknown God. And Luke wrote, "For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you." Paul point blankly tells the Athenians, you worship this God ignorantly. You do not know how to worship him. So there is ignorant worship. Go to Matthew 15. Matthew 15. Matthew 15, verses 8 and 9. Matthew 15, verses 8 and 9. "This people draweth nigh unto me with their mouth, and honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." And notice the first three words of verse 9. "But in vain they do worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." So there's ignorant worship, and there's vain worship. Those are two of the four. There's also will worship, Colossians 2 and verse 23. "Which things have indeed a show of wisdom in will worship and humility and neglecting of the body, not in any honor to the satisfying of the flesh." So will worship can be anything. It can be that we are doing our will instead of God's will. It can be that we are putting something before God. And I mean, all of these, it's still, if you are worshiping God, but you're not worshiping him the right way, and you don't know how to worship him the right way, you haven't been taught how to worship him the right way, that's ignorant worship. If you know how to worship him and you still choose to worship him your way, that's vain worship. And that's also will worship. You're doing what you want to do, what you feel is better than what God wants you to do. That was Colossians 2:23. Colossians 2:23. And then we can think of John 4:23 and 24. Spiritual worship. Worshiping him in spirit and in truth. And there, Jesus tells the woman at the well point blankly, there's a time that is coming. And I can't think of it right now, so let's turn there. John 4. John 4, 23 and 24. "But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshipper shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must," notice that word, "must, worship him in spirit and in truth." Must. That word must, it doesn't show that it's wishy-washy. It means that you could, but you don't have to. It doesn't mean that it's really up to you. It means that you must, as in, this is the way to do it, period. It doesn't mean, well, if you find a better way, then you can worship me that way. It's, I told you to do it this way, do it that way, period. What do we see most people doing today? Well, you know what? You know what? I'm all about Jesus, but I'm not about the religions of today. So I'm just gonna worship him from my recliner while I'm watching the game. I'm gonna be thinking of God while I'm watching the game. That's not in spirit and in truth. Oh, well, you know what? I feel closer to God when I'm kicked back in my boat and just throwing some reels. That's not in spirit and in truth. You can put anything there, and if it is not the way God has told you to, it's not in spirit, and it's not in truth. So let's look at that verse a bit more deeply. Do, I guess, a study of spiritual worship. As we've already been talking about, the word must shows it's imperative. You must worship him in this way. What's the proper subject to worship? Many people will get that mixed up. They'll think they're worshiping God, but they're actually worshiping John Calvin, Joseph Smith, Wesley Simon, whatever his name is, any of the men that have created a denomination. The people that worship in their denomination think they're worshiping God, but they're actually worshiping them. I mean, proper subject is God. What's the point of coming here if you're not going to worship God? Especially if you're not going to worship him the simple way that he's told you to. So what's the proper attitude? How are we supposed to worship God? Are we supposed to, I'll go because my wife told me to. No, it's not the right attitude. It's, I feel like worshiping him today. It's not the right attitude. It's in spirit. It's doing it because you want to. Doing it because you want to be here. I can always think of when I was after high school, before Memphis, and even after Memphis now, I would be at work or I would be somewhere and people would be talking about tomorrow's Sunday, and I'd be talking about, I'm excited that it's Sunday. And they're like, well, why? I'm like, well, because I get to go to church. And they're like, wait, what? And they get that look of like, Are you crazy? Are you daft? And it's, I love Sundays because I get to go to church. I get to worship God. There's something, and I don't understand it myself, but there's, I guess, this terminology for Sunday that's been called Suicide Sunday. And it all has to do with, I guess, that Sunday is the day that comes before Monday. So, you love Friday because it's the end of the work week. You love Saturday because it's the weekend. You come to Sunday, and you want to kill yourself because you just don't like Mondays. So it's something that I guess people have taken to and that some songs have been written about as Suicide Sunday. People think of Sunday that way in that they do not like it because that means the next day they have to go back to work. I think of it the opposite way. Even when I had to start going to work Sunday night in Mississippi, I still loved Sundays because I would go congregate with the brethren. I would worship God and I would either preach or I would hear someone preach. And then when I was in Memphis, we'd come back to class and one of the instructors would always say, well, did you preach the word? Did you have it preached to you? And it was just a joy because I was where I wanted to be and I was doing what I wanted to do. So it wasn't a Suicide Sunday for me. It was, I can't think of a witty thing to put in place of suicide that rhymes with suicide. It was just my favorite day. So, say that again? Exactly. So, we've talked about types of worship, we've studied worship, how we're supposed to do it, what's supposed to be done, what's the proper attitude, what's the proper subject. Now, worship that is authorized. And again, we all know about the acts of worship that are authorized. We know, most likely, the verses that we go to for them. We'll just go over them again. Because even when Paul was talking to Timothy yet again, he told him to keep the brethren in remembrance. Because there'll come a time, and it happens to me at work all the time. I work at Walmart, I clean the store, I know just about where everything is, but someone comes up and asks, hey, where's your guy's toilet paper? Toilet paper. I know where it is, I just can't think of where it is at that time. Once you're put on the spot, you can't think of where it is. Someone comes up to you and it's, you know what, you guys only sing a cappella music. How come you don't use instruments? Well, there's this verse, I think it's in Ephesians. I know it's in the New Testament. But you are called on to tell them where it is, and you go blank. So the five acts of worship: singing, praying, teaching, the Lord's Supper, and giving. Singing. If someone will turn to Ephesians 5:19, and then if someone else will go to Colossians 3:16. Ephesians 5:19 and Colossians 3:16. And Ephesians 5:19, if anyone has it. Thank you. Now notice the word Psalms. I have the King James Version, but the type of Bible it is, it's a keyword study Bible. And what it does is it has the people that, I guess, edited this particular one that did like all the study notes in it. They underlined the words in each verse that were important, and they put Strong's number next to it, which you can then go into the back of it and you can find that number, and it tells you the Greek word to it. Now the word for Psalms comes from Psalmos, and I mean, excuse me, I'm going blank here. Taking that, and then I think it's that word. If it's not, maybe Rick can correct me, or maybe if Raphael's in here, he can correct me. That word has inherent in it, like plucking an instrument. And so people will go to that and they'll say, well, that, if you're supposed to sing psalms, and the Greek has inherently that you're supposed to pluck an instrument, that means that instruments of music is okay in worship. Well, does it have to mean that? No, it doesn't. You can think of, we have our vocal cords, that when you speak that chord, or when you sing, that chord starts vibrating, and it's like it being plucked. And another thing I've heard people talk of is that plucking the heartstring. I don't remember correctly if the heartstring is an actual thing, but it's, you're singing from the heart, you're making melody in your heart. You are plucking the heartstring in worship to God. It might not be that word, but it's either in Ephesians 5:19 or Colossians 3:16. One of the words that is used there, the Greek has in it that the inherent plucking of an instrument. Colossians 3:16. Thank you. So let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom. And then it says, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms. So it's worded very much like Ephesians 5:19, but it's still written differently, because Ephesians 5:19 just says speaking to yourselves, or speaking to one another in psalms and hymns. So when we're singing, we're talking to one another, we're teaching one another, we're encouraging one another, and we're speaking to God. But then, as it says here, and as we've already talked of, we're teaching one another, and we're admonishing, or we're encouraging one another. And we can, again, think of Hebrews 10:25. Encouraging one another, exhorting one another as we see the day approaching. So, we sing a cappella only, one, to teach one another. So that means that we need to be singing songs that are scriptural. Or can we use some that they have just a little denominational error in them? We should sing scriptural songs because we're teaching one another. And we're exhorting one another. So we have singing, Ephesians 5:19, Colossians 3:16. Praying, Acts 2:42. And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship and in breaking of bread and in prayers. Now also go to 1 Timothy again. Go to 1 Timothy, go to chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2. And notice what Paul wrote in verses 1 and 2 of 1 Timothy chapter 2. He starts off with, I exhort therefore, again, I encourage you, I admonish you, therefore, that first of all, supplication, taking things to God in prayer, that supplication, prayers, intercessions, going before God on the behalf of others, going to God on our behalf, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men. And then notice, he clarifies, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. I love to hit on these two verses because a prayer is not just talking to God. A prayer is, one, you could say having a conversation with God. You're getting to know God. You're letting God know you. You're letting God know about the things you care. You're telling Him about the people that you care about and asking Him to help you with something that you can't do on your own, asking Him to help someone that's close to you because they're struggling. You're having a conversation with Him and you're letting Him know you. You find out who He is through His Word. You let Him know who you are through your prayer. And then He says to do this for all men. That means that we should, those of us that were alive when Jeffrey Dahmer was alive, that we should pray for Jeffrey Dahmer. That we should pray, or that we should have prayed for Adolf Hitler, for Joseph Stalin, for Benito Mussolini, for Osama bin Laden. Insert any name there, and that's someone we should pray for. We should pray for our current president, and we should pray for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and pray for anyone else in authority, for Congress. And why should we do this? Well, one, from the way they're living and from the way they're acting, they need God's help. They need God's direction. As Jeremiah said, it is not for man to direct his own steps, it's for God to. And He does it through the Word, and you can tell from our states, our nation's current path, that they are not leading it by this. So we're to pray for them because they are ruling. And because they're ruling, from Romans 13, they bear a sword that can do a lot of harm and that can do a lot of good. So we need to pray for them because they're leading us, that they lead us the right way, that they don't lead us into temptation, that they lead us away from evil. And I don't know, I'm just gonna say, someone might be sitting here thinking, well, I can't pray for someone like Barack Obama, like President Barack Obama. He's such an evil man, he's so vile. How can I pray for someone like him? How can I bring such a horrible man before God? When Paul wrote this to Timothy, the Emperor Nero, the one that would ultimately kill Paul, was on the throne. And I'm pretty sure at this time, Paul had a very good inkling that he was going to die. And he knew that Nero was a horrible man. I mean, it was public knowledge that Nero would take Christians, cover them in animal skins, and then light them and use them to light his garden so that he could walk by it. That he would sew them into the same skin and then throw them into the Colosseum for them to be eaten by a live animal. And yet he still said, pray for all men, for kings, and all that are in authority. Do we really have to worry about the current president sewing us into a skin and throwing us into a Colosseum? No. The worst we have to worry about is him telling us, oh, well, you can't speak like that. Oh, well, you can't say that about transgender people, homosexual people. Oh, well, you can't say that about Muslims. All we have to worry about is possibly a slap on the hand. Don't do that. I think it's safe to say that we can pray for him and that we need to pray for him. Because as Christians, we're to love every soul and we're to want to see every soul go to heaven. So singing, praying, you could say teaching, preaching. Teaching and preaching are the same thing. Preaching, you're just in the pulpit, preaching, teaching, you're in a classroom teaching others still. Acts 20 and verse 7. Acts 20 and verse 7. And upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul preached unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. So there, Paul preached. Now, I don't think we've ever had someone preach to us from using just the afternoon service from 5 until midnight, but preaching. How are we going to get to know God if someone is not telling us about God? If someone is not telling us what God likes, what God doesn't like, the only way we can know of Him and learn of Him is through His Word. If someone gets up there and they talk about, just because I can't think of any better example, Joel Osteen talking about his two children and how his daughter looks up to his son, how does that teach us about God? If someone gets up there and talks about, if you give me your money, then God's going to give you blessings. How are you getting to know God? You're getting to know that if you give this man your money, God will give you blessings, but how are you getting to know God? You're not. Singing, praying, teaching, preaching. Look at the first part of that verse. Acts 20 and verse 7. And upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, the Lord's Supper. And I don't know how Rick feels about this. I don't know how Raphael feels about it. When I read that, and upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, the way that reads to me is, I take it as my understanding is that the whole reason the early Christians came together wasn't to, the main point was not for them to sing songs. The main point wasn't for Paul to preach them. The main reason they came together was to partake of the Lord's Supper, to remember the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And then they found it a good time to also please God by singing and by hearing from His Word and by giving so that the Lord's will could be done. That's just my two cents. That's just an added bonus for you guys, free of charge. Just something for you to think of. So, singing, praying, teaching, Lord's Supper, and giving. And it doesn't have to take place in this order. That's not the authorized way for it to be done. It doesn't have to be singing, praying, teaching, Lord's Supper, giving. These are just the authorized acts that we can do. Giving. Look at 1 Corinthians 16. 1 Corinthians 16. 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1 and 2. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches of Galatia, even so do ye. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store, as God hath prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come. So we are to give upon the first day of the week. Does that mean that we can come by and leave our check on Saturday if we're not going to be here? It doesn't say that we can. So I don't know. I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that myself. But I know when we were going to Memphis that, there was the issue of some of the students that were preaching that they were not giving at, Forest Hill, which was the overseeing congregation for the Memphis School of Preaching. And the instructors were constantly telling us, you need to be giving at Forest Hill. That is where you are a member by coming to this school. They are doing so much for you. The least you can do is give to them. And they said, if you cannot make it for the services, at least leave your check so that the elders can pick it up on Sunday. I don't know. I'm not going to say we can do that. I'm not going to say we can't do it. If I say we can, I'm loosing something and I don't have the authority to do that. If I say we can't, I'm binding something that I don't have the authority to do so. We're just to give. And it says upon the first day of the week, I'm just going to put it this way. The Bible's clear enough on what day it's supposed to be done. Let's just stick to that. So singing, praying, teaching, Lord's Supper, giving. And that is a good point. And I mean, the point they were making is that you need to give at Forest Hill. You are a member there. If you do give at the congregation with which you work, give out of the check that you receive from working with them. But the point was, they were telling you to, by head or tail, find a way to leave a check that the elders of the Forest Hill congregation could put into their treasury. So that's that point. That is the lesson for this morning. Comments? The giving or? I'm still not catching it exactly. Exactly. I wasn't saying that we don't have to do that. I'm saying that my take on Acts 20 and verse 7 is that their main point that they came together for was taking the Lord's Supper. And they would also sing, they would also give, they would also hear from the Word. I'm not saying that they didn't do those things. I'm just saying my understanding of Acts 20 verse 7 is that the main point they came together for was remembering Christ by partaking of the Lord's Supper. Okay. Any other questions, comments?